Welcome to The Week Ahead in Russia, RFERL's Monday podcast about significant developments and upcoming events in Moscow and beyond. I'm Steve Gutterman, and my guest this week is Mark Galliotti, an analyst of Russian politics, an honorary professor at the UCL School of Slavonic and East European Studies in London, and the author of several books, including We Need to Talk About Putin and The Weaponization of Everything, which actually comes out in the UK and Europe tomorrow, and then in February in the US and other parts of the world. Thanks very much for joining me today, Mark.
No, it was a pleasure.
All right. Now, I'm afraid this week the focus is again going to be on the situation surrounding Ukraine, almost literally surrounding, with Russian forces seemingly still massing on three sides of the country, including now in its northern neighbor, Belarus. My basic question, Mark, is this. Diplomacy will clearly continue for some time, but for how long? Now, for me, both during the talks involving the United States, NATO, and the OSCE, and then last week when U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken spoke with and then met with Russian Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov, I had the sense that Russia could walk out at any moment and that after that, a Russian military escalation was possible or even likely. Now, why this sense? Well, mainly because of what seems to me like an unbridgeable gap on two of the biggest demands Russia laid out late last year, a binding pledge that Ukraine and other nations will never join NATO, and also a return to 1997 in terms of NATO deployments and military cooperation in Eastern Europe. Now, Russia says these really quite astonishing demands are absolute imperatives, but the United States and NATO say they're non-starters. Now, after the Blinken-Lavrov meeting on Friday in Geneva, it's clear that diplomacy will continue. But again, the question for me, at least, is for how long. Russia has asked for written responses to its proposed pacts with Washington and NATO, which contain those demands. And it's now expected that the United States will provide its response this week, I guess by Sunday, January 30th, I believe, and NATO in early February. Mark, do you think there's a real chance that diplomacy can continue much longer beyond early February, and that the threat of major military action could actually recede? Or is the collapse of diplomacy and a Russian escalation almost inevitable? Personally, I just don't see how Russia's very insistent stated position on these two demands leaves room for talks to continue much further, unless Moscow, in fact, climbs down from that position to some degree. And now there's another factor that came to the fore over the last week or so, with both the United States and Britain speaking of alleged Russian plots or efforts to install Moscow-friendly governments in Kiev. So that kind of raised the stakes again. What to make of those assertions, and how might they affect the diplomatic effort? Sorry, it's a lot to ask, but please go ahead.
Yeah, definitely a lot to unpack there. Well, look, if we start with the negotiations, there's one basic question, which is, were the negotiations either meant to fail as a pretext, saying, well, we tried, but we had no other alternative? Is it that they are genuine, but that the Russians will absolutely stick to this extraordinarily maximalist agenda, which means that ultimately that they will sooner rather than later come a point when they realize that, in fact, they're not going to get what they want? Mm-hmm. Or is it that there really is room for negotiation, and that precisely this maximalist agenda is actually, more than anything else, a very, very high start to a process of inevitable haggling? And that other things may well get sort of shaken out in the process. Well, I mean, to go through those options, I mean, if they were meant to fail, then in some ways it seems way too extensive and lengthy. If all you really want is a pretext, and let's be honest, I mean, who is this pretext for? It's not as though it's really for the West. It's not as though we're going to think, well, okay, then fair enough. They had no alternative but to escalate. Of course not. Likewise, in a way, Russians themselves, the Russian people, they're not at the moment being teed up for some kind of vicious and bloody war against, you know, their as they would think of it, sort of Slavic cousins in Ukraine. And I don't think, again, that there's any real sense that the length of negotiations is really going to be a factor in affecting their perspective. So I think in some ways we have to work on the assumption that although invasion or some other form of military escalation is definitely a possibility, these negotiations matter. Because if nothing else, even if today's plan is to, well, I mean, we've heard these extraordinary claims about, you know, taking Kyiv and whatever else, that may not be tomorrow's plan. There is still an attempt to firstly influence the Russian risk calculus, which I think is very important, but also to use these conversations to explore what may be acceptable to Putin. And I know it sounds awful. You know, there are those who will say, look, why should we be giving the Russians anything? Well, for the simple reason that, quite frankly, the less you're willing to give in terms of off-ramps, then the more vicious your attempts at deterrence have to be. And there are distinct limits to how much deterrent capability the West really has. So it's worth seeing about what room there is for things that do not actually impinge on Ukrainian sovereignty and the whole fundamental architecture of European security, but which nonetheless can be packaged up, given a nice little pink bow, and presented to Putin so that he can at least feel and tell his own people that he's won a victory. And in that respect, I was interested by the furore around what was clearly a gaffe on the part of President Biden in his press conference when he sort of made this sort of implication that, well, if it's only a little intervention into Ukraine, then that won't be so bad. Which, of course, was instantly walked back by, you know, Jem Psaki and Tony Blinken and so forth.
Right.
But the problem is that actually, in some ways, President Biden was actually telling the truth. It's that in diplomacy and negotiation, often the truth is something that you carefully meter and titrate. Look, there is a great division within Europe as to how far they're willing to go over Ukraine. There is a degree to which there are certain things that people are admitting privately, but not publicly, about, for example, the fact that Crimea is essentially lost to Ukraine, or indeed that Ukraine won't be part of NATO for the foreseeable future, which, you know, maybe actually give us some scope for the kind of packaging realities as if they're concessions. So, I mean, I think there is still room for creative diplomacy, but the key thing is, so long as the Russians are talking, they're not, on the whole, going to be fighting. Except, of course, the fighting we already see around the Donbass, but in some ways that has been kind of priced in, unfortunately, to the negotiations by now. But anyway, this is not going to be, if it's at all positive, it's not going to be a quick process. The only quick outcome we could have is if the Russians walk away.
Right.
Actually, you know, negotiations are long, painful, tedious things. And things like this, providing written responses, I think that's excellent. I think it's excellent for two reasons. One is because it allows the Russians to feel that they have won a little victory. You know, we demanded written responses and now we're getting them. You know, again, that's the sort of the human level concession that actually means nothing. But also, this is exactly the kind of thing on which the Russian foreign ministry in particular majors. The lengthy, tedious, pedantic, nitpicking discussion of what that semicolon there might mean. Anything we can do to, in effect, bog them down into this and have them feeling that they might get something out of it at the end is a good thing. Finally, on the talk about, you know, coups and puppet states and such like. I mean, it's difficult because of the extraordinary, unusual, and frankly problematic paucity of the information that was particularly in the British press release. That was frankly a press release where I couldn't see the point, because it said, oh, there are these people being, you know, with whom the Russians are having discussions about, you know, a future pro-Russian regime. But it doesn't then talk about sanctions. It doesn't talk about any kind of policy response. It just simply says, and British Foreign Secretary Liz Truss says, stop it. So it just seemed to be a strangely sort of vacuous document. It all absolutely could be true. And certainly I would be amazed if Russian agencies of one kind or another were not keeping lines out to everyone whom they think might be of any use. Mm-hmm. You know, after all, we have three Russian intelligence services all active in Ukraine, the FSB, the SVR, and military intelligence. We also have the presidential administration. We also have the foreign ministry. We also have the whole variety of sub-official, you know, minigarchs and oligarchs and media figures and academics and who knows who else, who in some ways are also geopolitical entrepreneurs. So, you know, between them, everyone's going to be having arm's length or direct conversations. That doesn't necessarily mean that there's any real intent for a kind of a coup and a puppet state, because that would imply that the Russians have a deliberate intention of taking Kyiv, or at least taking some substantial territorial area, which, you know, would presumably include cities such as, I don't know, maybe Dnipro, maybe Kharkiv or whatever. I mean, that would be a massive military operation. There is no way that any kind of puppet government can be maintained without occupation forces. Now, it could be that they're thinking in those maximalist terms, and we've seen these sort of scary maps doing the rounds in the media with all these sort of dynamic arrows showing, oh, how they would invade.
Right.
I think that is an extraordinarily extreme option, which I think would be, if nothing else, I mean, absolutely disastrous. I mean, that kind of ambitious attempt to take all or part of Ukraine, which would be met with such an extreme degree of resistance from the Ukrainians themselves, in my view. I mean, that's the kind of thing which ultimately I think could bring the Kremlin down. I mean, that would be the irony if actually the real story is not whether Moscow brings down Kyiv, it's whether Kyiv ends up bringing down Moscow.
Yeah, absolutely. Very interesting points. Just on that last one, this last issue. Yes, I mean, to me, kind of a personal aside almost, the idea of such a huge, you know, invasion and taking over Kyiv, installing a government, it's just hard to fathom. So, you know, I don't know what that adds to the analysis, probably nothing. But, you know, I think there might be goals that are less dramatic. Although, you know, and when you look at what Putin's written and said about Ukraine, you know, it's just hard to guess, of course, in the end. Another thing I'll just mention, you know, you spoke about the possibility for, you know, lengthy negotiations, the idea that the written response is kind of something that the Kremlin essentially and the foreign minister, Russian foreign minister, can take, you know, to the people and say, you know, we got them to do this. You know, and I think there have been signs in the Russian media of kind of you know, that the Kremlin is ready or maybe ready to portray things as victories. And of course, since they say they have no plans to invade, not doing so, you know, would not, you know, arguably would not be like backing down, because there's, you know, mm-hmm. Rabkov and others saying we're not invading. But also, to me, the idea, you know, Lavrov and I think and others have said a few times during these negotiations, we don't want NATO to drag it out. We don't want the U.S. to drag it out. You know, they're known for doing that. But it you know, I can't help thinking that, you know, over the past few weeks, certainly the U.S. is saying openly, you know, we're going to talk as long as we can. We want to keep the door for diplomacy open. But it does seem to me like Russia, you know, as you said, I think, or as you suggested, Russia is kind of dragging it out, or at least they're, you know, if they were going to leave, you know, maybe they would have done so earlier. So sorry, I didn't really put that in very clearly, but let's move on to the second question I want to ask, which is related to the first. You spoke about it on your most recent podcast, In Moscow's Shadows podcast, and I'd like to discuss it a bit here. Apologies. I'm talking about the bill proposed by Russian communist leader Gennady Zyuganov that would urge President Vladimir Putin to recognize the Russia-backed separatist groups that hold territory in eastern Ukraine and call themselves DNR and LNR, to recognize them as independent states. Now, there will be discussion of this in the State Duma, the lower parliament house, this week. And analysts, I think, have been differing quite a bit on this, in part because it's often said that such recognition would be a loss for Putin, not a win, that it would essentially deprive Moscow of a lever of influence over Ukraine and make it much harder to get any of what it's actually asking for from the United States and NATO. And what it's asking for has kind of increased dramatically in the past month or two. So the way I see it, there are basically three possibilities: that the Kremlin has decided to go ahead and recognize these groups, these anyway, as states. That second would be that Putin wants to give himself that option, and that the what happens will depend at least in part on how the talks further talks go with the West, or the third, that Putin wants to use this proposal by the communists to actually bat down the idea. What's your thinking on this, Mark?
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting because there has been chatter, after all, about this for some time, not necessarily linked specifically to the communists. You know, there's a particularly within the more nationalist wing of official and indeed unofficial non-systemic politics in Russia. There has been talk about, well, why are we not recognizing these people? Now, the fact that it's the communists, I mean, my first thought was, well, if it's the communists, then surely this isn't actually going to happen, because why would the Kremlin be willing to, in some ways, give the communists what looks like a victory? You know, given that the Communist Party, particularly in the Duma, is entirely sort of managed by the presidential administration and the Duma chair. But on the other hand, then I sort of thought about it a little bit more. And I think, you know, we're in a situation where actually this could either be the Kremlin wanting to sort of test it out, give it a trial balloon and see what happens, while distancing itself from the notion so that it hasn't put any political capital behind it. But it could also be as a sop to the Communist Party leadership, who, after all, are facing something of an onslaught at the moment from, on the one hand, the more opposition-minded radical members of its own party, who actually want it to be a real opposition party, and on the other hand, the Kremlin, that is clearly going after figures such as Moscow Communist Chief Rashkin, precisely because they're just a little bit too opposition-minded. So it might be an attempt to sort of build up the official leadership of the Communist Party by giving them the chance to be the sort of the spearhead in this, and then the Kremlin just simply says, well, clearly this is the will of the people, and that's why we're doing it. Now, would this be a defeat or a setback for Moscow? I mean, yes, on one level, it certainly would deprive the Kremlin of a lever over Ukraine. But one has to wonder just how effective that lever really is. I mean, it's often said that the presence of territorial conflicts within a country preclude it from NATO membership. There's actually no reason why that has to be the case. Mm-hmm. It's possible to find workarounds anyway, which would still allow Ukraine, in theory, to become part of NATO. So that's right. Not there. Mm-hmm. The Minsk process is essentially dead. And the sooner we come to recognize it, the better, because it's being argued over by both sides. But, it's not going to get anywhere. Neither Kyiv nor Moscow are willing to, shall we say, acknowledge the other side's interpretation of the Minsk process. So that's gone. So, I mean, in some ways, one might say that, in fact, really, there's not a big deal to this in terms of loss. And, again, if we're talking unacknowledged truths, I mean, I think to a large extent, Kyiv is in no great rush to reincorporate the Donbass. I mean, if Russia really wanted to torpedo Ukraine's chances of developing the way it wants to develop, it should just simply hand Donbass back tomorrow and say, well, do enjoy trying to reincorporate these ravaged, deindustrialized territories full of disgruntled people and heavily armed warlords. But that's obviously not going to happen. The thing is that for me, this looks like a potential plan, well, if not B, maybe plan C, maybe plan D. Mm-hmm. In other words, if you really don't think that you're going to get what you're looking for from the West, and if you are disinclined to take on the massive political, diplomatic, social and economic costs which would ensue from a further escalation, well, you recognize these pseudo-states, You deploy your Russian quote unquote peacekeepers, so you can overtly have your forces there, which kind of maintains a further point of leverage. Mm-hmm. It's quite interesting, by the way, that one of the signatories to the Communist Party bill in the Duma was Leonid Kalashnikov, who is the chair of the CIS, Commonwealth of Independent States Affairs Committee. So one would imagine that there'll be a drive to get this two or one, whatever, new pseudo-state into the CIS, which also brings with it certain sort of security guarantees. And they can at least claim that they have done something. Mm-hmm. I mean, again, this is one of the problems. Once you've actually built up these forces and so forth, if you don't get anything out of it, then you look silly, you look weak. And those are two things that Putin absolutely does not want to see. So this way, if Putin is thinking about both domestic politics, but also his historical legacy and so forth, what he can say is, we did this and we saved our Russian cousins of the Donbass from the kind of pogroms that the neo-fascists in Kiev would visit upon them. And we have now fixed this. And even if the West isn't willing to accept it, we know that they're now safe and our boys are there to keep them safe, because that's how Russia looks after its own. This is the thing about an authoritarian regime. It has massive capacity to spin whatever happens the way it would like. So, as I said, I mean, I can't possibly see this as the preferred outcome. Mm-hmm. But I can see this as a fallback. Again, this is how the Kremlin thinks. It does not have a single rigid plan. It has multiple options. And as and when it decides which, I can see this as one of these options where they think, well, if we're really stuck, if we really feel that we're not going to get anything and we don't risk the military option, this is at least something. And in some ways, to go back to President Biden's statement, obviously there would be uproar, there will be some form of sanctions, but I think the sanctions would be relatively limited to precisely the Donbass region, or the pseudo states and companies that are acting there and people who are there and so forth. It's the impact on Russia as a whole would be relatively limited, not least because Russia's already having to bankroll these areas anyway. So it's a way of manufacturing an apparent success out of a stalemate.
Yeah, that's extremely interesting. I think the U.S. and the Western response, if that were to happen, is a key question. I have to agree with you that it looks to me like a plan B, an option. We like to say Putin likes to create options. I think he really does. Plan B or C or D. And as you indicated, I think it would cost less than some kind of a full scale invasion. And very important point, it would enable Putin to say, I did this, here's the result. Whether the appetite for that among Russian, ordinary Russians, is big or not, I think it's still going to be something that he can take and say, this is the result, and it would allow Russia to say, or Moscow to say, we only did this because, the West and Kiev were being recalcitrant about, and didn't let us get any further anywhere else. So, I think it is an option that they would probably look at. And just to take it a little further, I think then the thinking in Moscow might be, well, we'll do this now, and then we'll see what happens, and we still can try to do something more with Ukraine. But for now we have this. So now I'm sounding like I think it's really going to happen, but I don't know, and it's very hard to guess, but we will continue to watch and see what happens in the next week or so of diplomacy and see what comes out of that. Okay, we're running out of time. We'll have to wrap it up. Mark, thanks very much for joining me.
As ever, a pleasure.
All right. Great insights. Great to have you on the podcast. I'll be back again next Monday. And please keep an eye out on Friday for my Week in Russia newsletter. Thanks for listening.